but laugh. "You're not my son," he told Bran when they fetched him down. "You're a squirrel." "So be it. If you must climb, then climb, but try not to let your mother see you." Bran did his best, although he did not think he ever really fooled her. Since his father would not forbid it, she turned to others. Old Nan told him a story about a bad little boy who climbed too high and was struck down by lightning, and how afterwards the crows came to peck out his eyes. Bran was not impressed. There were crow's nests atop the broken tower, where no one ever went but him, and sometimes he filled his pockets with corn before he climbed up there, and the crows ate it right out of his hand. None of them had ever shown the slightest bit of interest in pecking out his eyes. Later, Maester Lewin built a little pottery boy and dressed him in Bran's clothes and flung him off the wall into the yard below to demonstrate what would happen to Bran if he fell. That had been fun, but afterwards Bran just looked at the maester and said, "I'm not made of clay, and anyhow, I never fall." Then for a while the guards would chase him whenever they saw him on the roofs and try to haul him down. That was the best time of all. It was like playing a game with his brothers, except that Bran always won. None of the guards could climb half as well as Bran, not even Jory. Most of the time they never saw him anyway. People never looked up. That was another thing he liked about climbing. It was almost like being invisible. He liked how it felt, too, pulling himself up a wall, stone by stone, fingers and toes digging hard into the small crevices between. He always took off his boots and went barefoot when he climbed. It made him feel as if he had four hands instead of two. He liked the deep, sweet ache it left in the muscles afterwards. He liked the way the air tasted way up high, sweet and cold as a winter peach. He liked the birds, the crows in the broken tower, the little sparrows that nested in cracks between the stones, the ancient owl that slept in the dusty loft above the old armory. Bran knew them all. Most of all, he liked going places that no one else could go, and seeing the grey sprawl of Winterfell in a way that no one else ever saw it. It made the whole castle Bran's secret place. His favourite haunt was a broken tower. Once had been a watchtower, the tallest in Winterfell. A long time ago, 100 years before even his father had been born, a lightning strike had set it afire. The top third of the structure had collapsed inward, and the tower had never been rebuilt. Sometimes his father sent ratters into the base of the tower to clean out the nests they always found among the jumble of fallen stones and charred and rotten beams. But no one ever got up to the jagged top of the structure now, except Bran and the crows. He knew two ways to get there. You could climb straight up the side of the tower itself, but the stones were loose, the mortar that held them together long gone to ash, and Bran never liked to put his full weight on them. The best way was to start from the godswood, shinny up the tall sentinel, and cross over the armory and the guards' hall, leaping roof to roof, barefoot, so the guards wouldn't hear you overhead. That brought you up to the blind side of the first keep, the oldest part of the castle, a squat round fortress that was taller than it looked. Only rats and spiders live there now, but the old stones still made for good climbing. You could go straight up to where the gargoyles leaned out blindly over empty space, and swing from gargoyle to gargoyle, hand over hand, around to the north side. From there, if you really stretched, you could reach out and pull yourself over to the broken tower where it leaned close. The last part was a scramble up the blackened stones to the eyrie, no more than 10 feet, and then the crows would come round to see if you'd brought any corn. Bran was moving from gargoyle to gargoyle with the ease of long practice when he heard the voices. He was so startled, he almost lost his grip. The first keep had been empty all his life. "I do not like it," a woman was saying. There was a row of windows beneath him, and the voice was drifting out of the last window in his side. "You should be the hand." "Gods forbid," a man's voice replied lazily. "It's not an honor I'd want. There's far too much work involved. Bran hung, listening, suddenly afraid to go on. They might glimpse his feet if he tried to swing by. "Don't you see the danger this puts us in?" the woman said. "Robert loves the man like a brother." "Robert can barely stomach his brothers. Not that I blame him. Stannis would be enough to give anyone indigestion." "Oh, don't play the fool. Stannis and Renly are one thing, and Eddard Stark is quite another. Robert will listen to Stark." "Damn them both. I should have insisted that he name you. But I was certain Stark would refuse him." "We ought to count ourselves fortunate," the man said. "The king might easily have named one of his brothers, or even Littlefinger. Gods help us. Give me honourable enemies rather than ambitious ones, and I'll sleep more easily by night." They were talking about father, Bran realized. He wanted to hear more, a few more feet. But they would see him if he swung out in front of the window. "We will have to watch him carefully," the woman said. "I would sooner watch you," the man said. He sounded bored. "Come back here." "Lord Eddard has never taken any interest in anything that happens south of the Neck," the woman said. "Never, I tell you. He means to move against us. Why else would he leave the seat of his power?" "A 100 reasons. Duty, honour. He yearns to write his name large across the book of history, to get away from his wife, or both. Perhaps he just wants to be warm for once in his life." "His wife is Lady Aaron's sister. It's a wonder Lysa was not here to greet us with her accusations." Bran looked down. There was a narrow ledge beneath the window, only a few inches wide. He tried to lower himself toward it. Too far. He would never reach. "You fret too much. Lysa Aaron is a frightened cow. That frightened cow shared John Aaron's bed. But if she knew anything, she would have gone to Robert before she fled King's Landing. When he had already agreed to foster that weakling son of hers at Casterly Rock, I think not. She knew the boy's life would be hostage to her silence. She may grow bolder now that he's safe atop the Eyrie." "Tch, mothers!" The man made the word sound like a curse. "I think birthing does something to your mind. You're all mad." He laughed. It was a bitter sound. "Let Lady Aaron grow as bold as she likes. Whatever she knows, whatever she thinks she knows, she has no proof." He paused a moment. "Or does she?" "Do you think the king will require proof?" the woman said. "I tell you, he loves me not." "And whose fault is that, sweet sister?" Bran studied the ledge. He could drop down. It was too narrow to land on, but if he could catch hold as he fell past, pull himself up. Except that might make a noise, draw them to the window. He was not sure what he was hearing, but he knew it was not meant for his ears. "You are as blind as Robert," the woman was saying. "If you mean I see the same thing," the man said, "I see a man who would sooner die than betray his king." "He betrayed one already, or have you forgotten?" the woman said. "Oh, I don't deny he's loyal to Robert, that's obvious. What happens when Robert dies and Joff takes the throne? And the sooner that comes to pass, the safer we'll all be. My husband grows more restless every day. Having Stark beside him will only make him worse. He's still in love with the sister, the insipid little dead 16-year-old. How long till he decides to put me aside for some new Lyanna?" Bran was suddenly very frightened. He wanted nothing so much as to go back the way he had come, to find his brothers. Only what would he tell them? He had to get closer, Bran realized. He had to see who was talking. The man sighed. "You should think less about the future and more about the pleasures at hand." "Stop that," the woman said. Bran heard the sudden slap of flesh on flesh, then the man's laughter. Bran pulled himself up, climbed over the gargoyle, crawled out along the roof. This was the easy way. He moved across the roof to the next gargoyle, right above the window of the room where they were talking. "All this talk is getting very tiresome, sister," the man said. "Come here and be quiet." Bran sat astride the gargoyle, tightening his legs around it, and swung himself around upside down. He hung by his legs and slowly stretched his head down toward the window. The world seemed strange upside down. A courtyard swam dizzily below him, its stones still wet with melted snow. Bran looked in the window. Inside the room, a man and a woman were wrestling. They were both naked. Bran could not tell who they were. The man's back was to him, and his body screened the woman from view as he pushed her up against a wall. There were soft, wet sounds. Bran realized they were kissing. He watched, wide-eyed and frightened, his breath tight in his throat. The man had a hand down between her legs, and he must have been hurting her there, because the woman started to moan, low in her throat. "Stop it," she said. "Stop it. Stop it, please." But her voice was low and weak, and she did not push him away. Her hands buried themselves in his hair, his tangled golden hair, and pulled his face down to her breast. Bran saw her face. Her eyes were closed, and her mouth was open, moaning. Her golden hair swung from side to side as her head moved back and forth, but still he recognized the queen. He must have made a noise. Suddenly her eyes opened, and she was staring right at him. She screamed. Everything happened at once then. The woman pushed the man away wildly, shouting and pointing. Bran tried to pull himself up, bending double as he reached for the gargoyle. He was in too much of a hurry. His hand scraped uselessly across the smooth stone, and in his panic his leg slipped, and suddenly he was falling. There was an instant of vertigo, a sickening lurch as the window flashed past. He shut out a hand, grabbed for the ledge, lost it, caught it again with his other hand. He swung against the building hard. The impact took the breath out of him. Bran dangled, one-handed, panting. Faces appeared in the window above him. The queen. And now Bran recognized the man beside her. They looked as much alike as reflections in a mirror. "He saw us," the woman said shrilly.
"So he did," the man said.
Brian's fingers started to slip. He grabbed the ledge with his other hand. Fingernails dug into the unyielding stone. The man reached down.
"Take my hand," he said, "before you fall."
Bran seized his arm and held on tight with all his strength. The man yanked him up to the ledge.
"What are you doing?" the woman demanded.
The man ignored her. He was very strong. He stood Bran up on the sill.
"How old are you, boy?"
Seven, Bran said, shaking with relief. His fingers had dug deep gouges in the man's forearm. He let go sheepishly. The man looked over at the woman.
"The things I do for love," he said, with loathing.
He gave Bran a shove. Screaming, Bran fell backward out of the window into empty air. There was nothing to grab onto. The courtyard rushed up to meet him.
Somewhere in the distance, a wolf was howling. Crows circled the broken tower, waiting for corn. Tyrion. Somewhere in the great stone maze of Winterfell, a wolf howled. The sound hung over the castle like a flag of mourning. Tyrion Lannister looked up from his books and shivered, though the library was snug and warm. Something about the howling of a wolf took a man right out of his here and now and left him in a dark forest of the mind, running naked before the pack. When the direwolf howled again, Tyrion shut the heavy leather-bound cover of the book he was reading, a 100-year-old discourse on the changing of the seasons by a long-dead maester. He covered a yawn with the back of his hand. His reading lamp was flickering. It's all but gone as dawn light leaked through the high windows. He had been at it all night. Well, that was nothing new. Tyrion Lannister was not much a one for sleeping. His legs were stiff and sore as he eased down off the bench. He massaged some life back into them and limped heavily to the table where the septon was snoring softly, his head pillowed on an open book in front of him. Tyrion glanced at the title. A life of the Grand Maester Æthelmuir, no wonder.
"Sheel," he said softly. The young man jerked up, blinking, confused, the crystal of his order swinging wildly on its silver chain. "I'm off to break my fast. See that you return the books to the shelves, and be gentle with Valyrian scrolls. The parchment is very dry. Armadon's Engines of War is quite rare, and yours is the only complete copy I've ever seen." Sheel gaped at him, still half asleep. Patiently, Tyrion repeated his instructions, then clapped the septon on the shoulder and left him to his tasks. Outside, Tyrion swallowed a lungful of cold morning air and began his laborious descent of the steep stone steps that corkscrewed around the exterior of the library tower. It was slow going. The steps were cut, high and narrow, while his legs were short and twisted. The rising sun had not yet cleared the walls of Winterfell, but the men were already hard at it in the yard below. Sandor Clegane's rasping voice drifted up to him. "The boy's a long time dying. I wish he'd be quicker about it." Tyrion glanced down and saw the hounds standing with Yon Joffrey as squires swarmed around them. "At least he dies quietly," the prince replied. "It's the wolf that makes the noise. I could scarcely sleep last night." Clegane cast a long shadow over the hard-packed earth as his squire lowered the black helm over his head. "I could silence the creature, if it please you," he said through his open visor. The boy placed a long sword in his hand. He tested the weight of it, slicing at the cold morning air. Behind him, the yard rang to the clangor of steel on steel. The notion seemed to delight the prince. "Eh, send a dog to kill a dog," he exclaimed. "Winterfell is so infested with wolves, the Starks would never miss one." Tyrion hopped off the last step onto the yard. "I beg to differ, nephew," he said. "The Starks can count past six, unlike some princes I might name." Joffrey had the grace at least to blush. "A voice from nowhere," Sandor said. He peered through his helm, looking this way and that. "Spirits of the air." The prince laughed, as he always laughed when his bodyguard did this mama's farce. Tyrion was used to it. "Down here." The tall man peered down at the ground and pretended to notice him. "The little old Tyrion," he said. "My pardons, I did not see you standing there." "I'm in no mood for your insolence today." Tyrion turned to his nephew. "Joffrey, it is past time you called on Lord Eddard and his lady to offer them your comfort." Joffrey looked as petulant as only a boy prince can look. "What good will my comfort do them?" "None," Tyrion said. "Yet it is expected of you. Your absence has been noted." "The Stark boy is nothing to me," Joffrey said. "I cannot avoid the wailing of women." Tyrion Lannister reached up and slapped his nephew hard across the face. The boy's cheek began to redden. "One word," Tyrion said, "and I will hit you again." "I'm going to tell Mother," Joffrey exclaimed. Tyrion hit him again. Now both cheeks flamed. "You tell your mother," Tyrion told him, "but first, you get yourself to Lord and Lady Stark, and you fall to your knees in front of them, and you tell them how very sorry you are, and that you're at their service if there is the slightest thing you can do for them or theirs in this desperate hour, and that all your prayers go with them. Do you understand? Do you?" The boy looked as though he was going to cry. Instead, he managed a weak nod. Then he turned and fled headlong from the yard, holding his cheek. Tyrion watched him run. A shadow fell across his face. He turned to find Clegane looming overhead like a cliff. His soot-dark armor seemed to blot out the sun. He had lowered the visor over his helm. It was fashioned in the likeness of a snarling black hound, fearsome to behold. But Tyrion had always thought it a great improvement over Clegane's hideously burned face. "The prince will remember that, little lord." The helm turned his laugh into a hollow rumble. "I pray he does," Tyrion Lannister replied. "If he forgets, be a good dog and remind him." He glanced around the courtyard. "Do you know where I might find my brother?" "Breaking fast with the queen." "Ah," Tyrion said.
He gave Sandor Clegane a perfunctory nod and walked away as briskly as his stunted legs would carry him, whistling. He pitied the first knight to try the hound today. The man did have a temper. A cold, cheerless meal had been laid out in the morning room of the guest house. Jamie sat at table, and Cersei and the children talking in low, hushed voices.
"Is Robert still abed?"
Tyrion asked as he seated himself, uninvited, at the table. His sister peered at him with the same expression of faint distaste she had worn since the day he was born. "The king has not slept at all," she told him. "He is with Lord Eddard. He has taken their sorrow deeply to heart." "He has a large heart, our Robert," Jamie said with a lazy smile. There was very little that Jamie took seriously. Tyrion knew that about his brother and forgave it. During all the terrible long years of his childhood, only Jamie had ever shown him the smallest measure of affection or respect, and for that Tyrion was willing to forgive him most anything. A servant approached.
"Bread," Tyrion told him, "and two of those little fish, and a mug of that good dark beer to wash them down. Oh, and some bacon. Burn it until it turns black."
The man bowed and moved off. Tyrion looked back to his siblings. Twins, male and female. They looked very much the part this morning. Both had chosen a deep green that matched their eyes. Their blonde curls were all a fashionable tumble, and gold ornaments shone at wrists and fingers and throats. Tyrion wondered what it would be like to have a twin, and decided that he would rather not know. Bad enough to face himself in a looking-glass every day. Another him was a thought too dreadful to contemplate. Prince Tommen stood up.
"Do you have news of Bran, uncle?"
"I stopped by the sick room last night," Tyrion announced. "There was no change. The maester thought that was a hopeful sign."
"I don't want Brandon to die," Tommen said timorously. He was a sweet boy, not like his brother, but then Jamie and Tyrion were somewhat less than peas in a pod themselves. "Lord Eddard had a brother named Brandon as well," Jamie mused, "one of the hostages murdered by Targaryen. It seems to be an unlucky name."
"Oh, not so unlucky as all that, surely," Tyrion said.
The servant brought his plate. He ripped off a chunk of black bread. Cersei was studying him warily. "What do you mean?" Tyrion gave her a crooked smile.
"Why, only that Tommen may get his wish. The maester thinks the boy may yet live."
He took a sip of beer. Marcella gave a happy gasp, and Tommen smiled nervously, but it was not the children Tyrion was watching. The glance that passed between Jaime and Cersei lasted no more than a second, but he did not miss it. Then his sister dropped her gaze to the table. "That is no mercy. These northern guards are cruel to let the child linger in such pain."
"What were the maester's words?" Jamie asked.
The bacon crunched when he bit into it. Tyrion chewed thoughtfully for a moment and said,
"He thinks that if the boy were going to die, he would have done so already. It has been 4 days with no change."
"Will Bran get better, uncle?" little Marcella asked. She had all of her mother's beauty, but none of her nature.
"His back is broken, little one," Tyrion told her. "The fall shattered his legs as well. They keep him alive with honey and water, or he would starve to death. Perhaps, if he wakes, he will be able to eat real food, but he will never walk again."
"If he wakes," Cersei repeated, is that likely?"
"Well, the guards alone know," Tyrion told her. "The maester only hopes."
He chewed some more bread.
"I would swear that wolf of his is keeping the boy alive. The creatures outside his window, day and night, howling. Every time they chase it away, it returns. Maester said they closed the window once to shut out the noise, and Bran seemed to weaken. When they opened it again, his heart beat stronger."
The queen shuddered. "There is something unnatural about those animals," she said. "They are dangerous. I will not have any of them coming south with us." Jamie said,
"You'll have a hard time stopping them, sister. They follow those girls everywhere."
Tyrion started on his fish.
Are you leaving soon, men?
Not near soon enough, Cersei said. Then she frowned. Are we leaving? She echoed. What about you?
Gods, don't tell me you're staying here.
Tyrion shrugged.
Benjen Stark is returning to the Night's Watch with his brother's bastard. I've a mind to go with them and see this war we've all heard so much of.
Jaime smiled.
I hope you're not thinking of taking the black on us, sweet brother.
Tyrion laughed.
What, me? Celibate? The oars would go begging from Dorne to Casterly Rock. No, I just want to stand on top of the wall and piss off the edge of the world.
Cersei stood abruptly. The children don't need to hear this filth. Tommen, Myrcella, come. She strode briskly from the morning room, her train and her pups trailing behind her. Jaime Lannister regarded his brother thoughtfully with those cold green eyes.
Stark will never consent to leave Winterfell, with his son lingering in the shadow of death.
We will, if Robert commands it, Tyrion said.
And Robert will command it. There's nothing Lord Eddard can do for the boy in any case.
He could end his torment, Jaime said. I would, if it were my son. It would be a mercy.
I advise against putting that suggestion to Lord Eddard, sweet brother, Tyrion said. He would not take it kindly.
Even if the boy does live, he'll be a cripple, worse than a cripple, a grotesque. Give me a good clean death.
Tyrion replied with a shrug that accentuated the twist of his shoulders. Speaking for the grotesques, he said, I beg to differ. Death is so terribly final, while life is full of possibilities.
Jaime smiled.
You are a perverse little imp, aren't you?
Oh, yes, Tyrion admitted.
I hope the boy does wake. I would be most interested to hear what he might have to say.
His brother's smile curdled like sour milk.
Tyrion, my sweet brother, he said darkly, there are times when you give me cause to wonder whose side you are on.
Tyrion's mouth was full of bread and fish. He took a swallow of strong black beer to wash it all down and grinned up wolfishly at Jaime.
Why, Jaime, my sweet brother, he said, you wound me. You know how much I love my family.
John climbed the steps slowly, trying not to think that this might be the last time ever. Ghost padded silently beside him. Outside, snow swirled through the castle gates, and the yard was all noise and chaos. But inside the thick stone walls, it was still warm and quiet. Too quiet for John's liking. He reached the landing and stood for a moment, afraid. Ghost nuzzled at his hand. He took courage from that. He straightened and entered the room. Lady Stark was there beside his bed. She had been there, day and night, for close on a fortnight. Not for a moment had she left Bran's side. She had her meals brought to her there, and chamber pots as well, and a small hard bed to sleep on, though it was said she had scarcely slept at all. She fed him herself, the honey and water and herb mixture that sustained life. Not once did she leave the room, so John had stayed away. But now there was no more time. He stood in the door for a moment, afraid to speak, afraid to come closer. The window was open. Below, a wolf howled. Ghost heard and lifted his head. Lady Stark looked over. For a moment she did not seem to recognize him. Finally she blinked. "What are you doing here?" she asked in a voice strangely flat and emotionless. "I came to see Bran," John said, "to say goodbye." Her face did not change. Her long auburn hair was dull and tangled. She looked as though she had aged 20 years. "You said it. Now go away." Part of him wanted only to flee, but he knew that if he did, he might never see Bran again. He took a nervous step into the room. "Please," he said. Something cold moved in her eyes. "I told you to leave," she said. "We don't want you here." Once that would have sent him running. Once that might even have made him cry. Now it only made him angry. He would be a sworn brother of the Night's Watch soon, and face worse dangers than Catelyn Tully Stark. "He is my brother," he said. "Shall I call the guards?" "Call them," John said defiantly. "You can't stop me from seeing him." He crossed the room, keeping the bed between them, and looked down on Bran where he lay. She was holding one of his hands. It looked like a claw. This was not the Bran he remembered. The flesh had all gone from him, his skin stretched tight over bones like sticks. Under the blanket, his legs bent in ways that made John sick. His eyes were sunken deep into black pits, open, but they saw nothing. The fall had shrunken him somehow. He looked half a leaf, as if the first strong wind would carry him off to his grave. Yet under the frail cage of those shattered ribs, his chest rose and fell with each shallow breath. "Bran," he said, "I'm sorry I didn't come before. I was afraid." He could feel the tears rolling down his cheeks. John no longer cared. "Don't die, Bran, please. We're all waiting for you to wake up. Me and Rob and the girls, everyone." Lady Stark was watching. She had not raised a cry. John took that for acceptance. Outside the window, the dire wolf howled again, the wolf that Bran had not had time to name. "I have to go now," John said. "Uncle Benjen is waiting. I'm to go north to the wall. We have to leave today, before the snows come." He remembered how excited Bran had been at the prospect of the journey. It was more than he could bear, the thought of him leaving him behind like this. John brushed away his tears, leaned over, and kissed his brother lightly on the lips. "I wanted him to stay here with me," Lady Stark said softly. John watched her, wary. She was not even looking at him. She was talking to him, but for a part of her it was as though he were not even in the room. "I prayed for it," she said dully. "He was my special boy. I went to the Sept and prayed 7 times to the 7 faces of God that Ned would change his mind and leave him here with me. Sometimes prayers are answered." John did not know what to say. "It wasn't your fault," he managed after an awkward silence. Her eyes found him. They were full of poison. "I need none of your absolution, bastard." John lowered his eyes. She was cradling one of Bran's hands. He took the other, squeezed it, fingers like the bones of birds. "Goodbye," he said. He was at the door when she called out to him. "John," she said. He should have kept going. But she had never called him by his name before. He turned to find her looking at his face, as if she were seeing it for the first time. "Yes," he said. "It should have been you," she told him. Then she turned back to Bran and began to weep, her whole body shaking with the sobs. John had never seen her cry before. It was a long walk down to the yard. Outside, everything was noise and confusion. Wagons were being loaded, men were shouting, horses were being harnessed and saddled and led from the stables. A light snow had begun to fall, and everyone was in an uproar to be off. Rob was in the middle of it, shouting commands with the best of them. He seemed to have grown of late, as if Bran's fall and his mother's collapse had somehow made him stronger. Grey Wind was at his side. "Uncle Benjen is looking for you," he told John. "He wanted to be gone an hour ago." "I know," John said. "Soon." He looked around at all the noise and confusion. "Leaving is harder than I thought." "For me too," Rob said. He had snow in his hair, melting from the heat of his body. "Did you see him?" John nodded, not trusting himself to speak. "He's not going to die," Rob said. "I know it." "You Starks are hard to kill," John agreed. His voice was flat and tired. The visit had taken all the strength from him. Rob knew something was wrong. "My mother..."
"She was very kind," John told him.
Rob looked relieved.
"Good," he smiled. "The next time I see you, you'll be all in black."
John forced himself to smile back. "It was always my color. How long do you think it will be?"
"Soon enough," Rob promised. He pulled John to him and embraced him fiercely.
"Farewell, Snow."
John hugged him back.
"And you, Stark. Take care of Bran."
"I will."
They broke apart and looked at each other awkwardly.
"Uncle Benjen said to send you to the stable if I saw you," Rob said finally.
"I have one more farewell to make," John told him.
"Then I haven't seen you," Rob replied.
John left him standing there in the snow, surrounded by wagons and wolves and horses. It was a short walk to the armory. He picked up his package and took the covered bridge across to the keep. Arya was in her room, packing a polished ironwood chest that was bigger than she was. Nymeria was helping. Arya would only have to point, and the wolf would bound across the room, snatch up some wisp of silk in her jaws, and fetch it back. But when she smelled ghost, she sat down on her haunches and yelped at them. Arya glanced behind her, saw John, and jumped to her feet. She threw her skinny arms tight around his neck.
"I was afraid you were gone," she said, her breath catching in her throat. "They wouldn't let me come out to say goodbye."
"What did you do now?" John was amused.
Arya disentangled herself from him and made a face.
"Nothing. I was all packed and everything." She gestured at the huge chest, no more than a third full, and at the clothes that were scattered all over the room. "Septa Mordain says I have to do it all over. My clothes weren't properly folded," she said. "A proper southern lady doesn't just throw her clothes inside her chest like old rags," she said.
"Is that what you did, little sister?"
"Well, they're going to get all messed up anyway," she said. "Who cares how they're folded?"
"Septa Mordain," John told her. "I don't think she'd like Nymeria helping either." The she-wolf regarded him silently with her dark golden eyes. "It's just as well."
"I have something for you to take with you, and has to be packed very carefully."
Her face lit up.
"A present?"
"You could call it that." "Close the door." Wary but excited, Arya checked the hall. "Nymeria, here, guard." She left the wolf out there to warn of intruders and close the door. By then, John had pulled off the rags he'd wrapped it in. He held it out to her.
Arya's eyes went wide, dark eyes like his.
"A sword," she said, in a small, hushed breath. The scabbard was soft grey leather, supple as sin.
John drew out the blade slowly, so she could see the deep blue sheen of the steel.
"This is no toy," he told her. "Be careful you don't cut yourself. The edges are sharp enough to shave with."
"Girls don't shave," Arya said.
"Maybe they should. Have you ever seen the Scepter's legs?"
She giggled at him.
"It's so skinny."
"So are you," John told her. "I had Micken make this special. The Bravos use swords like this in Pentos and Myr and the other free cities. It won't hack a man's head off, but it can poke him full of holes, if you're fast enough."
"I can be fast," Arya said. "You'll have to work at it every day." He put the sword in her hands, showed her how to hold it, and stepped back.
"How does it feel?"
"Do you like the balance?"
"I think so," Arya said.
"First lesson," John said. "Stick them with a pointy end."
Arya gave him a whap on the arm with the flat of the blade. The blow stung, but John found himself grinning like an idiot.
"I know which end to use," Arya said.
A doubtful look crossed her face.
"Septa Mordain will take it away from me."
"Not if she doesn't know you have it," John said.
"Who will I practice with?"
"Oh, you'll find someone," John promised her. "King's Landing is a true city, 1,000 times the size of Winterfell. Until you find a partner, watch how they fight in the yard. Run and ride, make yourself strong, and whatever you do—"
Arya knew what was coming next. They said it together. "Don't tell Sansa."
John messed up her hair.
"I will miss you, little sister. Suddenly she looked like she was going to cry. Wish you were coming with us. Different roads sometimes lead to the same castle. Who knows? He was feeling better now. He was not going to let himself be sad. I'd better go. I'll spend my first year on the wall emptying chamber pots if I keep Uncle Ben waiting any longer. Arya ran to him for a last hug. Put down the sword first, John warned her, laughing. She set it aside almost shyly and showered him with kisses. When he turned back at the door, she was holding it again, trying it for balance. I almost forgot, he told her. All the best swords have names. Like ice, she said. She looked at the blade in hand. Does this have a name? Oh, tell me. Can't you guess? John teased. Your very favorite thing? Arya seemed puzzled at first. Then it came to her. She was that quick. They said it together. Needle! The memory of her laughter warmed him on the long ride north. Daenerys Targaryen wed Khal Drogo with fear and barbaric splendor in a field beyond the walls of Pentos, for the Dothraki believe that all things of importance in a man's life must be done beneath the open sky. Drogo had called his Khalasar to attend him, and they had come, 40,000 Dothraki warriors and uncounted numbers of women, children, and slaves. Outside the city walls they camped, with their vast herds, raising palaces of woven grass, eating everything in sight, and making the good folk of Pentos more anxious with every passing day. "My fellow magisters have double the size of the city guard," Illyrio told them over platters of honey duck and orange snap peppers one night at the manse that had been Drogo's. The Khal had joined his Khalasar, his estate given over to Daenerys and her brother until the wedding. "Best get Princess Daenerys wedded quickly before they hand half the wealth of Pentos away to sellswords and bravos," Sir Jorah Mormont jested. The exile had offered her brother his sword the night Dany had been sold to Khal Drogo. Viserys had accepted eagerly. Mormont had been their constant companion ever since. Magister Illyrio laughed lightly through his forked beard, but Viserys did not so much as smile. "He can have it tomorrow if he likes," her brother said. He glanced over at Dany, and she lowered her eyes. "So long as he pays the price." Illyrio waved a languid hand in the air, rings glittering on his fat fingers. "I have told you all is settled. Trust me. The Khal has promised you a crown, and you shall have it."
"Yes, but when?"
"When the Khal chooses," Illyrio said. "He will have the girl first, and after they are wed, he must make his procession across the plains and present her to the Dush Kaleen at Vaes Dothrak. After that, perhaps, if the omens favour war." Viserys seethed with impatience. "I piss on Dothraki omens. The usurper sits on my father's throne. How long must I wait?" Illyrio gave her a massive shrug. "You have waited most of your life, great king. What is another few months, another few years?"
Sir Jorah, who had travelled as far east as Vaes Dothrak, nodded in agreement.
"I counsel you to be patient, your grace. The Dothraki are true to their word, but they do things in their own time. A lesser man may beg a favour from the Khal, but must never presume to berate him."
Viserys bristled.
"Guard your tongue, Mormont, or I have it out. I'm no lesser man. I'm the rightful lord of the Seven Kingdoms. The dragon does not beg."
Sir Jorah lowered his eyes respectfully. Illyrio smiled enigmatically and tore a wing from the duck. Honey and grease ran down over his fingers and dripped down into his beard as he nibbled at the tender meat.
"There are no more dragons," Dany thought, staring at her brother, though she did not dare say it aloud.
Yet that night she dreamt of one. Viserys was hitting her, hurting her. She was naked, clumsy with fear. She ran from him, but her body seemed thick and ungainly. He struck her again. She stumbled and fell. "You woke the dragon," he screamed as he kicked her. "You woke the dragon! You woke the dragon!" Her thighs were slick with blood. She closed her eyes and whimpered. As if in answer, there was a hideous ripping sound and the crackling of some great fire. When she looked again, Viserys was gone. Great columns of flame rose all around, and in the midst of them was the dragon. It turned its great head slowly. When its molten eyes found hers, she woke, shaking, and covered with a fine sheen of sweat. She had never been so afraid. Until the day of her wedding came at last. The ceremony began at dawn and continued until dusk, an endless day of drinking and feasting and fighting. A mighty earthen ramp had been raised amid the grass palaces, and there Danny was seated beside Khal Drogo above the seething sea of Dothraki. She had never seen so many people in one place, nor people so strange and frightening. The horse lords might put on rich fabrics and sweet perfumes when they visited the free cities, but out under the open sky they kept the old ways. Men and women alike wore painted leather vests over bare chests, and horsehair leggings cinched their bronze medallion belts, and the warriors greased their long braids with fat from the rendering pits. They gorged themselves on horse flesh roasted with honey and peppers, drank themselves blind on fermented mare's milk and Illyrio's fine wines, and spat jests at each other across the fires, their voices harsh and alien in Danny's ears. Viserys was seated just below her, splendid in a new black wool tunic with a scarlet dragon on the chest. Illyrio and Ser Jorah sat beside him. Theirs was a place of high honour, just below the Khal's own blood riders. But Danny could see the anger in her brother's lilac eyes. He did not like sitting beneath her, and he fumed when the slaves offered each dish first to the Khal and his bride, and served him from the portions they refused. He could do nothing but nurse his resentment. So nurse it he did, his mood growing blacker by the hour at each insult to his person. Danny had never felt so alone as she did, seated in the midst of that vast horde. Her brother had told her to smile, and so she smiled until her face ached, and the tears came unbidden to her eyes. She did her best to hide them, knowing how angry Viserys would be if he saw her crying, terrified of how Khal Drogo might react. Food was brought to her, steaming joints of meat and thick black sausages and Dothraki blood pies and later fruits and sweetgrass stews and delicate pastries from the kitchens of Pentos, but she waved it all away. Her stomach was a royal, and she knew she could keep none of it down. There was no one to talk to. Khal Drogo shouted commands and jests down to his blood riders and laughed at their replies, but he scarcely glanced at Danny beside him. They had no common language. Dothraki was incomprehensible to her, and the Khal knew only a few words of the bastard Valyrian of the free cities, and none at all of the common tongue of the Seven Kingdoms. She would even have welcomed the conversation of Illyrio and her brother, but they were too far below to hear her. So she sat in her wedding silks, nursing a cup of honeyed wine, afraid to eat, talking silently to herself. "I am Blood of the Dragon," she told herself. "I am Daenerys Stormborn, Princess of Dragonstone, of the blood and seed of Aegon the Conqueror." The sun was only a quarter of the way up in the sky when she saw her first man die. Drums were beating as some of the women danced for the Khal. Drogo watched without expression, but his eyes followed their movements, and from time to time he would toss down a bronze medallion for the women to fight over. The warriors were watching, too. One of them finally stepped into the circle, grabbed a dancer by the arm, pushed her down to the ground, and mounted her, right there, as a stallion mounts a mare. Illyrio had told her this might happen. "The Dothraki mate like the animals in their herds. There is no privacy in a Khalasar, and they do not understand sin or shame as we do."
Danny looked away from the coupling, frightened when she realized what was happening. But a second warrior stepped forward, and a third, and soon there was no way to avert her eyes. Then two men seized the same woman. She heard a shout, saw a shove, and in the blink of an eye, the Areks were out, long, razor-sharp blades, half-sword and half-scythe. A dance of death began as the warriors circled and slashed, leaping toward each other, whirling the blades around their heads, shrieking insults at each clash. No one made a move to interfere. It ended as quickly as it began. The Areks shivered together faster than Danny could follow. One man missed a step, the other swung his blade in a flat arc, steel bit into flesh, just above the Dothraki's waist, and opened him from backbone to belly button, spilling his entrails into the dust. As the loser died, the winner took hold of the nearest woman, not even the one they had been quarrelling over, and had her there and then. Slaves carried off the body, and the dancing resumed. Master Illyrio had warned Danny about this, too. "A Dothraki wedding without at least three deaths is deemed a dull affair," he had said. Her wedding must have been especially blessed. Before this day was over, a dozen men had died. As the hour passed, the terror grew in Danny, until it was all she could do not to scream. She was afraid of the Dothraki, whose ways seemed alien and monstrous, as if they were beasts in human skins and not true men at all. She was afraid of her brother, of what he might do if she failed him. Most of all, she was afraid of what would happen tonight under the stars, when her brother gave her up to the hulking giant who sat drinking beside her with a face as still and cruel as a bronze mask.
"I am the blood of the dragon," she told herself again.
When at last the sun was low in the sky, Khal Drogo clapped his hands together, and the drums and the shouting and the feasting came to a sudden halt. Drogo stood and pulled Danny to her feet beside him. It was time for her bride gifts. And after the gifts, she knew, after the sun had gone down, it would be time for the first ride and the consummation of their marriage. Danny tried to put the thought aside, but it would not leave her. She hugged herself to try to keep from shaking. Her brother Viserys gifted her with three handmaids. Danny knew they had cost him nothing. Illyria, no doubt, had provided the girls. Iri and Jiqui were copper-skinned Dothraki with black hair and almond-shaped eyes. Doria, a fair-haired, blue-eyed Lycene girl. "These are no common servants, sweet sister," her brother told her as they were brought forward one by one. "Illyrio and I select them personally for you. Iri will teach you riding, Jiqui, the Dothraki tongue, and Doria will instruct you in the womanly arts of love." He smiled thinly. "She's very good. Illyrio and I can both swear to that. Sir Jorah Mormont apologized for his gift. It's a small thing, my princess, but all a poor exile could afford," he said as he laid a small stack of old books before her. They were histories and songs of the Seven Kingdoms, she saw, written in the common tongue. She thanked him with all her heart. Master Illyrio murmured a command, and four burly slaves hurried forward, bearing between them a great cedar chest bound in bronze. When she opened it, she found piles of the finest velvets and damasks the free cities could produce, and resting on top, nestled
in the soft cloth, three huge eggs. Danny gasped. They were the most beautiful things she had ever seen, each different than the others, patterned in such rich colours that at first she thought they were crusted with jewels, and so large it took both hands to hold one. She lifted it delicately, expecting that it would be made of some fine porcelain or delicate enamel, or even blown glass. But it was much heavier than that, as if it were all of solid stone. The surface of the shell was covered with tiny scales, and as she turned the egg between her fingers, they shimmered like polished metal in the light of the setting sun. One egg was a deep green with burnished bronze flecks that came and went depending on how Danny turned it. Another was pale cream streaked with gold. The last was black as a midnight sea, yet alive with scarlet ripples and swirls. "What are they?" she asked, her voice hushed and full of wonder. "Dragon's eggs from the shadow lands beyond Ashai," said Magister Illyrio. "The Eons have turned them to stone, yet still they burn bright with beauty." "I shall treasure them always." Danny had heard tales of such eggs, but she had never seen one, nor thought to see one. It was a truly magnificent gift, though she knew that Illyrio could afford to be lavish. He had collected a fortune in horses and slaves for his part in selling her to Khal Drogo. The Khal's blood riders offered her the traditional three weapons, and splendid weapons they were. Hago gave her a great leather whip with a silver handle, Kaholo a magnificent arrack chased in gold, and Kotho a double-curved dragon-bone bow taller than she was. Magister Illyrio and Sir Jorah had taught her the traditional refusals for these offerings. "This is a gift worthy of a great warrior, O blood of my blood, and I am but a woman. Let my lord husband bear these gifts in my stead." And so Khal Drogo, too, received his bride gifts. Other gifts she was given in plenty by other Dothraki. Slippers and jewels and silver rings for her hair, medallion belts and painted vests and soft furs, sand silks and jars of scent, needles and feathers and tiny bottles of purple glass, and a gown made from the skin of 1,000 mice. "A handsome gift, Khaleesi," Magister Illyrio said of the last, after he had told her what it was. "Most lucky." The gifts mounted up around her in great piles, more gifts than she could possibly imagine, more gifts than she could want or use. And last of all, Khal Drogo brought forth his own bride gift to her. An expectant hush rippled out from the center of the camp as he left her side, growing until it had swallowed the whole Khalasar. When he returned, the dense press of Dothraki gift-givers parted before him, and he led the horse to her. She was a young filly, spirited and splendid. Danny knew just enough about horses to know that this was no ordinary animal. There was something about her that took her breath away. She was grey as the winter sea, with a mane like silver smoke. Hesitantly, she reached out and stroked the horse's neck, ran her fingers through the silver of her mane. Khal Drogo said something in Dothraki, and Magister Illyrio translated. "Silver for the silver of your hair," the Khal says. "She's beautiful," Danny murmured. "She is the pride of the Khalasar," Illyrio said. "Custom decrees that the Khaleesi must ride a mount worthy of her place by the side of the Khal." Drogo stepped forward and put his hands on her waist. He lifted her up as easily as if she were a child and set her on the thin Dothraki saddle, so much smaller than the one she was used to. Danny sat there, uncertain for a moment. No one had told her about this part. "What should I do?" she asked Illyrio.
It was Sir Gerard Mormont who answered. "Take the reins and ride."